We are continuing our study of the 10th Psalm. In this Psalm, the writer, who we think is David, has found himself in some difficulty. He is oppressed by his enemies, and his enemies happen to also be the enemies of God because they are wicked persons. And he spends the first half of this Psalm talking about the characteristics of the enemy, the characteristics of the wicked. And we're right in the midst of his description of the wicked. In verse 4 he says, "The wicked, through the pride of his countenance, will not seek after God. God is not in all his thoughts." So the wicked has too much pride to seek after God. He's too interested in himself and in his own desires and fulfilling his needs to think about God or to have God in his thoughts. And we discussed that verse in the last lesson. So now, beginning with the 5th verse, we have a further description of these enemies. He says in verse 5, "His ways are always grievous. Thy judgments are far above, out of his sight. As for all his enemies, he puffeth at them." So another characteristic of the enemy of David, and consequently the enemy of God, is that his paths or his ways are always grievous. And to be always grievous means that he's always perverse. He is he's hard. He's out of step with God. He's out of harmony with the plan and the rules and the laws of God. And this states that they're always that way. His actions are continually found to be that way. Once we really get out of step with the things of God, once we get out of harmony with his laws and his rules, then we find ourselves going on a course, pursuing a path, pursuing a way that is out of the way of God. We're walking in a way that is not his way. We're going in the wrong direction. And so every step that we take is a step in the wrong direction from the way that God would have us to go. So we're found to always be that way. Always be grievous. Always be a source of discomfort or displeasure or a source of provoking to God. And he further describes him in this 5th verse by saying, "Thy judgments are far above, out of his sight." Now the judgments here that he's talking about are the laws of God. "Thy judgments, thy laws, thy commandments are far above, out of his sight." That is, he is not able to comprehend them. He's not thinking the type of thoughts that would be conducive to understanding the will of God. He has such a philosophy of life that causes his sight or his view to be looking in the very opposite direction of what God would have him to do, so that the laws of God are out of his sight. He doesn't see the laws of God in the things that a follower of God would see them in. He is seeing other things besides God. He's seeing a law that is a law of the world, a law of the flesh, a law that is one that would fulfill the lusts. He sees his own pride and arrogance. He sees his own self blown up into such an unnormal, unnatural height that he is blinded to the laws of God. "So thy judgments are far above, out of his sight." And then he concludes that verse by saying, "As for all his enemies, he puffeth at them." That is, he is so proud and so haughty that he looks upon his enemies in a state of contempt. He puffeth at them, which means he blows at them or he sweeps them away with a breath. He doesn't have any feeling. He doesn't have any way to relate to them other than to try to blast them away. So we see here that he is a very self-centered person. He's always opposed to the things of God. He's not able to even see the judgments or the laws of God. And when it comes to enemies, when it comes to those that are not agreeing with him, then his all-crowning motive is to get rid of them. He puffeth at them. Verse 6, "He has said in his heart, I shall not be moved, for I shall never be in adversity." This phrase, which says he has said in his heart, really means that this is his philosophy. This is his belief. This is what he has predicated all of his actions upon, is this belief. He said it in his heart. That is, he holds it in his innermost self. This is the thing that he has as his motivating factor. It is in his mind. He said in his heart, "I shall not be moved." That is, I'm not going to have any of my good things taken away from me. I'm not going to find myself in any kind of difficulty. I have safety. I have security. I am all sufficient. I do not need anyone to assist me. I shall not be moved. And he concludes by saying, "For I shall never be in adversity." I shall never be in a state in which I'm going to be in wanting or needing. I'll always have plenty. This is his principle of life. This is his philosophy. And the translators say that this word here for adversity really means that he's never going to have his family to cease, or his successors, his offspring to cease to be prosperous too, that he'll be able to take all of his wealth and goods and pass them on so that his family and his name will continue to be in a state of prosperity and honor. And so we see then how that here again, pride is leading this person into a position in which he does not depend upon God. God is not in his plan or in his thoughts. He thinks that he is all self-sufficient, that he's able to sustain himself without having any outside help from God. And so he is truly so lifted by pride that he is blind to the ways and to the will of God. Now, this belief, this philosophy that I am all self-sufficient, that I shall never be moved, I shall never be in adversity, I shall never have anything come along that's going to cause me to be in a state of distress. This is opposed to what God would have his children, his people, to believe. We are to be in a humble state. We are to realize that we must depend upon God for our well-being, that we then look to God, we turn to God for all of our blessings, and that we then give God the thanks and give God the credit for having given us these blessings. So we utterly destroy our feeling and our state of pride that this person seems to be cultivating so highly in this sixth verse. Verse 7, his mouth is full of cursing and deceit and fraud. So here we see another very great characteristic of those that are unsatisfactory to God, those that are not the followers of God. They sin with their mouth. Their mouth, or his mouth, is full of cursing. Now this word here for cursing means that he uses profaneness. He is very apt to call upon the name of God in a profane way. He's very apt to swear. And we find that many times those that are ungodly use the name of God more than the godly do, because they're using it in a false way. They're using it in a profane way. They're using it in a way that is a mockery to God. They're taking God's name in vain. But this ungodly person is going to have this kind of language to come from his mouth. He says his mouth is full of it. It's full of cursing. And we find the Apostle Paul quoting from this in Romans 3:14, and where he is describing the wicked in general, he there talks about his mouth being full of cursing. And this verse further says his mouth is full of cursing and deceit. This word for deceit means falsity or lies or some kind of a deceptive practice that would be covered up. And not only full of deceit, but also fraud. And the word for fraud actually means violence. So his mouth then is an instrument that he uses in such a way as to bring about such a terrible state of disgrace upon himself. His mouth is full of cursing and deceit and fraud. He willingly and very prolifically can tell lies. He can bring forth with his words violence or harm to someone. And he further says then, under his tongue is mischief and vanity. So his very tongue then is harboring these terrible thoughts, ideas, words, so that his tongue brings forth mischief, which is another word for trouble, and vanity, which is iniquity. So his tongue is one then that produces trouble and iniquity. And, of course, we have to be most careful about our use of the tongue. Although the tongue is a little member, the tongue can carry much power with it. James speaks of the tongue and the power that it has and how it can be so badly misused. In James, the 3rd chapter, beginning with the 5th verse, even so the tongue is a little member and boasteth great things. Beholdeth how great a matter a little fire kindleth. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. So is the tongue among our members, that it defileth the whole body, and setteth on fire the course of nature, and is set on fire of hell. For every kind of beast, and of birds, and of serpents, and of things in the sea is tamed, and hath been tamed of mankind, but the tongue can no man tame. It is an unruly evil, full of deadly poison. Therewith bless we God, even the Father, and therewith curse we men, which are made after the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceedeth blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not so to be. Doth the fountain send forth at the same place sweet water and bitter? Can the fig tree, my brethren, bear olive berries, either a vine figs? So can no fountain both yield salt water and fresh. Who is a wise man and endued with knowledge among you? Let him show out of a good conversation his works with meekness and wisdom. So we see there's some very important teaching about the tongue. We can allow our tongue to become a member that is unruly. We can allow it to be something that is misused. We can allow it to be something that causes us then to be very unpleasing to God. Now, the tongue has a lot of power. The ability of humans to communicate is a very powerful and a very important characteristic. For us to not be able to communicate puts us at a very definite disadvantage in this life. And the better we're able to communicate, the more of an advantage it is to us. But this power for good can also be turned equally then into a power for bad. And that's what the wicked do. Their mouth is full of cursing and deceit and fraud. Under his tongue is mischief and vanity, or trouble and iniquity. So we see then we can determine a person's character just by listening to them talk. See what kind of words come out of their mouth. What kind of thoughts are being formulated in their heart and produced then with that tongue. And as we listen to persons talk, we can very well know what kind of a life they're living, what kind of a character they have, and what their standing is in the sight of God, because their speech will betray them. And the speech of the wicked here is described in this 7th verse. Verse 8, he sitteth in the lurking places of the villages. That is, whether this is actually literal in every case or has some figurative meaning, it's hard to say, but this person who is so wicked, who is opposed to God, finds the lurking places, that is the hiding places of the villages, where people live in a group. He finds the lurking places, or the places where he's going to be out of sight so much. And there he plots and plans his mischief. This verse further says, in the secret places doth he murder the innocent. That is, he takes advantage of the innocent, whether he literally puts them to death, or whether he is treating them in such a way as to hold them in contempt so that he would be willing to murder them. He would be willing to do them some kind of harm. Would all be the same. If we have murder in our heart, although we never lay a hand on anyone, we really are guilty of murder to that extent. And so the innocent are those that haven't done him any wrong. It doesn't mean that they are innocent of all sins, that they have never done anything wrong themselves, but this wicked person doesn't have any reason to do this. They haven't given him any true cause to treat them that way. But in the secret places doth he murder the innocent. That is, his actions are hidden. He does these things in a secret way. He does these things that are underhanded and not in the open, so that whenever it happens, it's not clear as to who brought it about, who the cause of the problem was, because this person is operating in a secret way, or in the lurking places of the villages. And verse 8 further says, his eyes are privately set against the poor. That is, his eyes secretly watch. They are looking at the prey. They're observing the actions and the movements and the condition of the prey, but they're doing it in such a way that they are not noticed. They are privately set against the poor. And the poor here, again, are those that this person would take advantage of. He is continually taking advantage of others. He is continually working and plotting and secretly doing things against them in such a private way that he's not that open about it. It's not that easy to tell or to know who is doing it, but nevertheless, he's the perpetrator of the wicked that comes upon the poor or upon the innocent. In verse 9, he further illustrates this activity of the wicked persons. He says, he lieth in wait secretly as a lion in his den. So it compares him to a lion now. A lion that would lie in his den, lay there in a secret way, unseen, unheard, and then he further says, he lieth in wait to catch the poor. So as the poor walks by the den, as the poor gets within striking distance, then the lion leaps and traps and catches the poor. Then he further says, he doth catch the poor when he draweth him into his net. Then he is now comparing this wicked man to a hunter who is seeking after the prey. And so he has set his net, he set his trap, and then when the poor gets near enough to it, and he springs the trap on him, he draweth him into his net. So just other ways to describe how the wicked is oppressing the poor. Like a lion would when he attacks his prey that comes near the den, or like a hunter would when he catches him in a trap that he set for him. And he further says in verse 10, He croucheth and humbleth himself, that the poor may fall by strong ones. Now this verse actually is not originally to be translated the way that we have it here in the King James. This word for croucheth really means that he crushes his victims. So he crushes his victims. He humbleth the victims. This is not talking about himself being crouched down or himself being humbled, but he crushes the victims. He humbles the victims. He overcomes them. And he further says that the poor may fall by his strong ones. Now the strong ones would be those that work with this wicked person. They're the ones he has following him, or he's hired them, or they're conspirators along with him. They may be like young athletic types. They have physical prowess, and they're using this in the wrong way, and they cause the poor ones to fall. And the word here for poor really means the afflicted ones, the victims. So we see then that this person who is so wicked doesn't always work by himself. He has co-workers. He has those that have the ability, physically and mentally, to overcome the afflicted or the poor. They are in a constant state of doing wrong to others. They're in a constant state of getting gain at other persons' expense. They overcome them. Whether it's either physical violence, like to rob them, or whether it is to simply defraud and cheat them by improper means, it doesn't really matter. The outcome is the same. The poor, the afflicted, are caused to fall. They are crushed. They are humbled. And the wicked are the ones who are doing this. Now, one thing we need to learn here is that if we're going to be acceptable to God, if we're going to be counted among those that are well-pleasing to God, we must be most careful as to how we treat our fellow man. We cannot allow ourselves to be in the position of cheating or defrauding or in any wise bringing about some harm to our fellow human beings. This is against what God wants. This puts us in the class here of those that are wicked. This puts us in the class of those that have grievous ways. Those that are continually fighting at our fellow man and not really serving God. And consequently, then we've missed our true reason for being on this earth. We've missed our purpose for being here alive on this earth. And then we are most displeasing to God. So we should ask ourselves, are our activities of such a nature that we can be described as those that are striking out at others? Are we continually trying to crush, to overcome, to overwhelm our fellow human beings, those with whom we have to deal on a day-by-day basis? Or do we find ourselves having pity and compassion upon others? Do we continually try to do good to them? Do we continually try to do something that's going to make their life better for having encountered us rather than worse for having had any dealings with us? Which classification do we fall into? Are we among those that are counted as the wicked, or are we among those that then would be counted as righteous that are doing good unto others? In verse 11, we have another very great characteristic of the wicked. He has said in his heart, God hath forgotten. He hideth his face, he will never see it. This verse states one of the means that the wicked uses to be able to do the things that he does and to turn against God and still not feel so badly about it. Because he cons himself into believing that God hath forgotten. He cons himself into thinking that God does not remember his evil deeds. He says this in his heart. This is one of the basic beliefs that he has. He may not want to openly express this, but whenever his conscience begins to bother him, when he begins to feel some sense of guilt for his wrongdoing, when he begins to think about what this is going to mean for him in the judgment day and in the eternal life after this one, then he soothes over these troubled feelings by simply convincing himself that God hath forgotten. He says, he hideth his face, he will never see it. That is, he persuades himself, he convinces himself that God does not see his wrongdoing, that somehow or other he can go about this evil life, he can lurk to take advantage of those that are oppressed by him, he can continually be waging a warfare against his fellow man, and that God just somehow or other doesn't take any notice of what he does, that God will never see it, that God hides his face, or that God is forgotten. And of course, when we can make ourselves believe this, then we have made ourselves go against one of the greatest principles that we know about God, and that is that God does know, God does see, God does remember, and so we can never escape the all-knowing and all-seeing character of God. God continually is aware of our actions, whether they be good, whether they be bad, God knows about them. And so for us to convince ourselves that God doesn't remember, that God doesn't see, is just simply a palliative way to make ourselves feel not quite so guilty about what we do. So we have given in this verse one of the great truths as to why the wicked continue to be wicked, why a man will turn against God, why a man will do those things that he knows that really are not right and proper, and it's because he has convinced himself that God is not going to see, God's not going to remember, that God has hidden his face, and so he makes himself believe that he'll not be punished for this, that he'll not have to have it to face God, that there'll be no consequences for what he does, for somehow or other what he does happens to be something that is secret that even God doesn't know about, and so everything he can get away with, he's just that much better off for it because it'll never be found out about. But we know that this is a delusion that the wicked have. It is an absolute false belief on their part. We're going to close at that point. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.